Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The American media has often been criticized for bias in coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Our guest this morning in this hour, author journalist Marta Dunsky, took a close look at how more than two dozen major news outlets did indeed report the story over recent years, and she says she believes that mainstream reporting does not purposely tilt one way or another. She does, however, find some important omissions, things that are left out and not dealt with in the reporting, including the impact that U.S. policy has on this conflict. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about how the media has covered this story. It is the subject of a book that she has authored, and the title is Pens and Swords, How the American Mainstream Media Report the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. It's published by the Columbia University Press. It's out, I'm sure you could find it in the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at the book. She is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. She's going to give a talk to the journalism department today at noon, and we're pleased to have her here to spend some time with us. Just a little bit more about her. She has been an Arab affairs reporter for the Jerusalem Post. She also at one time was editor on the National Foreign Desk of the Chicago Tribune. She developed and taught a media literacy course on American mainstream reporting of this conflict at Northwestern and DePaul, and now teaches part-time at DePaul University. She is a graduate of the University of Illinois. And we're pleased to have her here. Questions, of course, are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just be brief in their comments so we can keep moving along, get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you can give us a call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Let me ask the basic question, and certainly it is a contentious one, and people do have strong feelings one way or another, and that is, when you look at the coverage of this story, is the American media, the mainstream media, and we're talking here about big outlets, like the Tribune or the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, or the big broadcast, over-the-air broadcast networks, or for that matter, I'm sure you count CNN in on this.
Right.
All of these major sources of news that people are exposed to in the way that they have covered this conflict. Some people would say there is a very strong bias. They would say either it leans toward the Israeli point of view and their concerns, or it leans towards the Palestinian point of view and their concerns. What do you think?
Well, I think that in the day-to-day short-term coverage of the conflict, especially when there are heightened periods of violence, the audience sensitivity to this issue goes way up. And that's not surprising because people have constituent interests on one side or another. And given the events, of any particular news day and what's accessible to journalists in the field, there might be complaints. I think that the reporting of the back-and-forth violence and the suffering felt by both sides over time tends to balance out. But on any given day, for example, if there's, the attack on the yeshiva in Jerusalem last week would normally and naturally focus on the victims of that attack and the immediate aftermath, the grief of their friends and families. So that would point in one direction. What was going on in the week or 10 days or 2 weeks previous in Gaza might on a particular day point to, you know, a Palestinian point or Palestinian points of view. But as I said, over time, that tends to balance out in terms of these types of issues. So I think it's important not just to look at any one day or the news events of one day, but look at things over time.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it is true, and I think it's been demonstrated that people in as they follow the news, are selective in that whatever is most important to them, they're going to filter what they see through that. And I think that particularly things that don't reflect the point of view that they're looking for, they're going to take more notice of that. They're going to pay attention to that so that it's more likely that they're going to get all riled up about a story that they don't agree with or doesn't quite show the world that as the way that they think that it is, and not pay quite as much attention to those reports that are in harmony with the way that they think the world.
Yeah, I think that's human nature. We tend to pay more attention to and emphasize the things that agree with our points of view and minimize those that don't. What I've done in the book is not so much look at those particular issues about what is in the coverage on a day-to-day basis, keyed to immediate daily news events, but to look at some more underlying organic issues which over time and across media are pretty much omitted. In other words, what's not there. There's a bias in what's not there as opposed to what is.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that, because I think here one of the major points that you make is that, indeed, is that it's what we should be thinking about, maybe quite not so much as what is there as what's not. Important things that are left out. And that all goes to the issue of context, I think.
Unfortunately,
I think that's true of an awful lot of reporting, not just on international issues, but domestic issues as well, that, you know, news media generally does a pretty good job on the who, what, when stuff,
right,
but doesn't do a very good job in answering the why question and talking about all the things that surround that story.
Yes.
That might influence. And one thing in particular that I think you concentrate on is American policy in the Middle East.
Yes. I come at this from a journalistic point of view, and I want to make it clear I'm not a political scientist. But it's clear to all observers, or should be clear to all observers and students of the conflict, that American policy has had a tremendous impact and imprint on the trajectory of this conflict for at least the last 40 years. That's, I think, pretty much an undeniable fact. Now, it can be interpreted a number of ways. But when the United States has such a significant impact, interest in this conflict, and has one of the parties to the conflict as a major strategic ally to whom we have extended very considerable economic, military, and political support, this is a very important conflict in how factor in how the conflict plays out. Mm. However, the impact of American policy in all but very cursory ways is pretty much ignored in the coverage. Another thing that's ignored, the other set of factors, is what international law and consensus, how they have addressed two very key issues that will need to be resolved if there is a negotiated resolution to the conflict. Now, the two issues that are not included here, which are included in this group of key issues, are where the lines to the borders of the eventual final borders or permanent borders of the State of Israel and a future Palestinian state will be drawn, number one. And number two, what will be the capital? Will it be a joint capital in Jerusalem? Will there be two separate capitals? What will be the jurisdiction and sovereignty of that capital or capitals? The two issues that international law and consensus do address directly are the key issues of the disposition of the Israeli settlements, both in the West Bank and the urban settlements around, in and around Jerusalem, which have been established on land occupied by Israel as a result of the 1967 war, and also the status of the Palestinian refugees and their right to return. Mm-hmm. These two issues have been clearly addressed by international law and consensus. However, in reporting these two issues, the mainstream media, American mainstream media, tend to either overlook, minimize, or completely omit discussion of this. So these two types of omissions taken together, the impact of American policy on the trajectory of the conflict, number one, and number two, how international law and consensus have for many years addressed these two key issues, the refugee issue and the settlements issue, basically aren't there in the coverage. So what we do get in the coverage basically boils down to the stop and start diplomatic and political process, which over the years has produced some incremental progress toward a resolution. But the ultimate negotiated resolution to the conflict remains at this point still elusive. And the sporadic intercommunal violence, which can either be, you know, over a rather short period, as we saw over the last week or two, first in Gaza and inside the Israeli border towns and then in Jerusalem, the Israeli-Palestinian response to each other in terms of dealing with these problems militarily and in terms of violence and resistance. And there's no dots that connect the why of why the political and diplomatic process fails to produce a solution and the violence keeps going on. And in my view, these two omitted elements in terms of U.S. policy and international law and consensus on key issues could provide some important answers to or dots that would connect those two issues. But when those issues are omitted from the coverage, the viewing and reading public are usually left with the ideas that, number one, these two peoples have been fighting each other forever. And number two, this is hopeless because it keeps going on. And we've seen this before. And these very destructive and unfortunate patterns of violence keep repeating themselves.
And I think that that's, you could make that kind of criticism about the coverage of a lot of conflicts around the world where there may be people who feel like they have some sort of stake in it and have strong feelings one way or another. But then there are a lot of people who don't, and so who read this coverage and they come away with exactly that sort of viewpoint that said, well, you know, these people have been killing each other forever and they're probably just going to go on that way. It's an intractable conflict. So why do we even bother trying to intervene or to do anything about it? And that very thing, people have said that about Northern Ireland, and they said that about the Balkans, and they've said that about places in Africa, and they've said that about the Middle East. And I think there's good reason to be concerned about coverage that perpetuates that kind of, well, shrug your shoulders kind of reaction
nothing can be done. Right. And that's why the role of the journalist in covering these conflicts is so important, especially in a free society where, you know, the government doesn't dictate what you can and can't print, publish, broadcast, that the journalists, you know, have free rein to explore those issues. Obviously, the daily point and shoot of the who, what, when, where, and why are very important. We need to know developments on a daily basis. I'm not suggesting that we should get rid of all of that and just have documentary journalism on this conflict, because obviously time and space don't allow for that kind of reinventing of these contextual issues on a daily basis. But over time, certainly, journalists should be able to and want to answer these underlying why contextual questions in this conflict as well as coverage of other conflicts as well.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Marta Dunsky, she's the author of the book Pens and Swords, How the American Mainstream Media Report the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. The book is published by Columbia University Press. She now teaches part-time at DePaul University, and she also has been a journalist, is and has been journalist and an author. She is former Arab Affairs reporter for the Jerusalem Post. She also worked at one time as editor on the National Foreign Desk at the Chicago Tribune and has developed and taught a media literacy course on American mainstream reporting of the Arab and Muslim worlds at Northwestern University and also at DePaul. She's here visiting the campus, going to talk with people in the journalism department today. Questions are welcome. We have several, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. First, we'll go to Joliet and our line number four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Good topic. I'm one of those skeptics, I guess. I believe that the media is biased because it seems like every time there's some kind of conflict out there, the first ones to come out and make a comment about it are the Democrats. Now, I'm neither a Democrat nor a Republican, but this has been going on for years about everything that's out there. Secondly, anybody that knows the Middle East and studied history knows that that conflict over there is a never-ending story. It's been going on for, 1,000 years or something. And the whole Middle East is like that. And I can see where anybody can think those people will be reasonable enough to sit down and talk to one another. I do firmly believe that probably about half the people that are there probably want some kind of solution, but there's the other half that's so ingrained in the youngsters. I know somebody that's from over there, and they teach youngsters from the time they're born almost, all the way up to get, you know, the hatred, the mongering. So, you know, it's hard for us as Americans to understand unless you talk to somebody who's born and raised over there. You know, it's hard to say. I think personally the American media in this country doesn't get it. They just don't get it when you go to another country unless you're over there. That's why I think a lot of the British and maybe Israeli or Arab reporters seem to get more of it, what's going on there, the feel of the area, versus us just trying to sensationalize. I think that's the biggest thing.
Well, let's get some comments. I think there again, you get the articulation of that viewpoint, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people who would share it here in the United States, that this is an intractable conflict that's been going on for a very long time, and that it seems unlikely that it's going to stop anytime soon.
Well, first of all, I would say with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, while certainly both peoples have roots and historical claims in that area that are thousands of years old, the conflict that we see continuing to unfold on the pages of our newspapers and across our television screens and also coming through our radio waves is basically a little more than 100 years old, not more than that. And if we look at the impact, first of British policy in the 20s and 30s through the 1940s, and then after World War II, and particularly through the Cold War, of American policy in the region, we can see that we're not necessarily looking at biblical era hatreds that have carried over to present day. Certainly, the two peoples have very old and deep-rooted claims on that piece of land. But the interests of outside powers, again, first the British and now the United States, serve to tremendously complicate and add many layers of depth to this conflict. And those are, in a historical sense, very recent phenomena. That's number one. Number two, I think the caller has made a very interesting and important point. The last thing that he said about how American reporters seem to have one sort of take on this conflict, whereas if you look at Arab media or Israeli media or British media, you get different perspectives. And I think that is a very important point to consider. And one of the points that I make in the book, and again, this is related to the impact of U.S. policy on the conflict, is that the American mainstream media hew very, very closely to the American policy line in this conflict.
That is the policy line of the American, of the U.S. government.
Yes. Yeah. So in terms of which sources to interview, which questions to ask, what frames of reference there are, you know, American journalists are, you know, no surprise and no guilt here, part and parcel of their own political and other types of culture. The question is, when you go abroad or when you're writing on international topics, how do you try to see yourself, meaning the policy of your own country, in that picture, and certainly take it into account, quote it and reflect it accurately, but also to apply some analysis, critical analysis, to what is the impact of this, and how do our interests either coincide with or collide with the interests of people who are physical combatants in this conflict, namely the Israelis and the Palestinians. And that's where I think you see differences in how media of other countries report this conflict, because the policies of their governments aren't the same naturally as the policies of the United States. Mm-hmm. So the message here is that it would serve us all well if, in addition to reporting what American policy is, American journalists can also take somewhat of a critical, and by that I don't mean negative, but critical in the sense of analytical, look through analysis, quoting of expert nonpartisan sources, looking at certain documentary sources that help us understand why is our policy that way and what impact does it have on this conflict.
Yeah. And I guess, again, it goes back to the point you made that I think that often the American media does reflect this. It shows people in the American government saying, look, this conflict, it doesn't have anything to do with us. It's about the Palestinians and the Israelis, and that the day they want to stop killing each other will help them see if they can work something out. But you know, but it also doesn't we're not really in this. And I think that that really denies the fact that, as you say, that the U.S. government, in fact, is in it.
Well, I don't know that American, you know, representatives of the American government would necessarily say we're not really in this. But what they will say over and over again, the sort of conventional wisdom is the United States is an honest broker. Well, honest broker in the sense of spending political capital to bring the two sides together, certainly. Mm-hmm. But can we be an honest broker when one party to the conflict has been, and probably will continue to be much more important, at least in the official view, to our interests in the region than the other side? Then how honest a broker in terms of being balanced, let's leave aside objective or impartial, but a balanced approach. Another thing to consider is one thing I did in the book at a couple different junctures is to quote at length transcripts from State Department briefings. Now, these are available to the public. You can go online, www.state.gov, I think the URL is. You can go to the website of the U.S. State Department, and they post transcripts of press briefings. And you can see how, in Washington, American journalists will question or try to question the policy of American policy toward the conflict, for example. A number of years ago, and this is something that crops up repeatedly. It wasn't unique to this one time, but I think it was in 2004, Israel had announced that the government was accepting bids for construction of new housing units and settlements on the West Bank. Now, this was understood to be in direct violation to Israel's commitment to the U.S.-sponsored so-called roadmap peace plan at the time. So the day after this was announced in the Israeli media, American journalists posed questions to whoever the State Department spokesman was on that particular day at this press briefing and repeatedly tried to get the spokesman to comment, well, what do you say about this? Doesn't this violate our own policy? What are you doing about this? And the spokesman obfuscated. And I reproduced, you know, two or three pages of this transcript in the book to give readers an idea of it's almost like the libretto of a comic opera. The journalists are asking the question, the government representative dodges it. They try to ask it from a different angle. The representative obfuscates from that different angle. The point is, by obfuscating, the journalists don't come away with a story from that briefing. So the journalistic question is that the end of the reporting process? When you don't get anything you can really use, there are no sound bites there, there are no quotable quotes, the State Department spokesman hasn't really said anything. A, in my view, that's a story in and of itself. And B, then you go to some other sources. In other words, you get out of your chair or you go to a different place in your Rolodex and you do more reporting. But unfortunately, a lot of times, it stops and it starts there. And then in the field, in the actual field of conflict between, you know, over in Israel and the Palestinian areas, it's a lot of he said, or he said, she said type of sourcing. Well, to a certain extent, this is good. You want to convey Israeli points of view and Palestinian points of view. That's a necessary part of the coverage. But it has to go deeper than that. It should be broader than that. And this is another issue, is the issue of sourcing. It's very superficial.
We have some other folks to talk with. We're already at our midpoint here. Let's go next to someone in Indiana, Westphalia, Indiana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. The press in the United States, I get more information about Britney Spears. I'm not counting NPR because that's where I get most of my information in the BBC. They don't cover the story. If they do cover it, it's only because there's a bombing or somebody's children are killed or something like that. They don't cover the whole story.
Well, fair criticism, I think, and particularly that when it comes to international news. And actually, I think about how back after 9/11, suddenly we were saying that the media had dropped the ball on covering international stories and that this was now going to become more important. Well, I'm not necessarily sure that it has. And a lot of news organizations to that point had actually cut back. They had closed their foreign bureaus. They had fewer reporters working outside of the United States. And it was really difficult to cover stories if you don't have reporters there to do it. Do you think that has changed?
Well, obviously, a lot of this is driven by economics. You know, mm-hmm. it's expensive to operate foreign bureaus, and it's expensive to give reporters the time they need to do more than just go out and cover the bombing and cover the carnage. You know, someone like Britney Spears is the best thing to happen. These types of personalities are profit centers for corporate-driven media because, you know, you don't even have to add water. All you have to do is stir. You don't need to report anything. These are spectacles. But again, Britney Spears is entertainment. International affairs are crucial. We may not think so on a day-to-day basis, but we're living in a globalized society, a global world, a global economy. And certainly, if nothing else, and I think there were many lessons to be derived from the events of September 11, 2001, it's that we, through our policies and through our relationships with other countries, other peoples, you know, this stuff does matter to us, especially when it comes home to roost right here. And that's precisely why attention to international affairs is so crucial, because especially in the Middle East, I think we can arguably say that American policy, we are engaged militarily, economically, diplomatically at levels unprecedented by necessity in our own interest. And that's precisely why, more than the superficial, oh, a bomb went off, we'll cover how many people got blown up today or got shot today, is important. This particular conflict, I might add, a lot of the critique that I apply to this reporting could be extended to other conflicts, both past and present. It's not unique to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in terms of these patterns of reporting in a general sense. The question is, why is this particular conflict of special interest to the United States and to the American public? Well, there are any number of reasons, and I would say off the top of my head, two are. Number one, we have, and probably for the most likely or definitely for the foreseeable future, invest a lot of foreign aid in this region in general, and granted to Israel in particular, number one. And number two, our policies toward this conflict are at the top of the radar screen of people in the Arab and Muslim worlds who, when they have been repeatedly polled in recent years since 9/11, among other factors, consistently point to U.S. policy in this conflict as one of the top reasons why they are resentful toward or their opinions about the United States have declined precipitously in recent years. Hmm. This is a very important factor. And that's why it's important to us as Americans living here.
Hmm. We're past our midpoint here again. I want to thank the caller and go on into Champaign County for our next person here, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I want to offer what I think is the most recent best illustration of the entire bankruptcy of the American media and reporting in the Middle East, and that is the fact that you have to go to Vanity Fair to find a British reporter, David Rose, to chronicle what he calls Iran-Contra II, arming of, when Americans think about the coup in the Gaza, they think about the Hamas coup against Fatah, but the Rose points out that the real story is that the U.S., through Elliot Abrams, curiously enough, was helping arm through Egypt Fatah to perform a coup against after vaunting an election in the area. I've just done a little due diligence and found that the New York Times, one of the major people in the story is this guy David Wormser, who resigned from Cheney's office. And I Googled his name on the general Google News and found there was no American mention of his name in the aftermath of the story. Your former paper, the Jerusalem Post, had a story headlined, "Bush Authorized Coup Against Hamas." The Washington Post has a blog by a guy named Fromkin where Wormser is mentioned around the same time. So there's one mention on the New York Times had no follow-up on this revelation, the story. I mean, it is absolutely mind-boggling. I've seen this for a long time, but this is such a good case illustration of this is a direct American role in fomenting violence. And people who were watching it closely knew at the time that this was going on. In fact, one of the lower-level State Department people, I forget his name right now, was cheering on the violence in the Gaza when the factional fight was happening. And we're just sort of innocent bystanders. It's absolutely absurd. I'd like for you to react.
All right, go ahead.
Well, I think you're raising an excellent point, and I know I've read the Vanity Fair piece to which you're referring, which gives, you know, front and center play to this issue that there was direct American intervention in backing the Fatah faction against Hamas in Gaza last summer. And, you know, the side we were backing did not prevail militarily. Hamas won the fight militarily, took over Gaza, and the American response to that was to encourage the formation of a separate sort of breakaway government with Mahmoud Abbas, the president, and, you know, a new prime minister, Salim Fayyad, who was elected by no one. So now there's Hamas-controlled Gaza, and there's the so-called more moderate Palestinian government in the West Bank. And this is not entirely a creation of U.S. policy, but the American imprint in this is very large. And I will just say that at the time this was playing out on the ground in May and June of 2007, there was, I don't know if it was a page one story, but I'm looking at the footnote in my book. The Washington Post did report this story. The byline was Scott Wilson, and the headline was Fatah Troops Enter Gaza with Israeli Assent. Hundreds were trained in Egypt under U.S.-backed program to counter Hamas. So this was reported by the Washington Post, but in a very fleeting way. It was there, not on a blog, in the print edition of the paper, but still, it was fleeting. It came and went. And the underlying comment here is that here's American policy directly intervening in fomenting the chaos, and in you know, basically the American public is unaware of it, I think is a very accurate observation indeed.
Yeah. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus, and for the benefit of anyone who's just tuned in, I want to again introduce our guest, Marta Dunsky. She's author and journalist. She's a former Arab affairs reporter for the Jerusalem Post and former editor on the National Foreign Desk of the Chicago Tribune. She developed and has taught a media literacy course on American mainstream reporting of the Arab Muslim worlds at both Northwestern and DePaul, where she is now teaching. She is a graduate of the University of Illinois. She's here visiting the campus and going to talk to the faculty and journalists at a noontime talk today. And if you're also interested in this particular subject, that is how the American mainstream media has reported the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you can look for her book, Pens and Swords. It is published by the Columbia University Press. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. That's the number to call if you want to get in on the conversation. Next, we'll talk with someone in Urbana. This is line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to compliment your guest on correcting the first caller that this has not been a conflict going on for thousands of years. Actually, I would say that it was a little less than 100 years she gave it, but very close to 100 years. And that the I would like to add that the Zionists who are at the heart of one side of the conflict are not native Middle Easterners. They're Europeans. That prior to their arrival, there was a population of native Jews, also Christians and Baha'i, and they seemed to get along with the Muslims pretty well. rather better than our European ancestors did with themselves. And actually, the area was ruled not by Arabs or Jews. The rule had for a few hundred years been Turkish. And contrary to the myth that has been perpetrated by the Zionists, it was not an unpopulated area, and it was not an undeveloped area. It was not a land searching for people, for a people. It was a well-developed area. The population was prosperous, comparatively well-educated, very much like their Lebanese neighbors, and certainly multicultural and well-developed.
Well, let's get some comments again from the guest.
I would also make one other point. When the Sephardic Jews were driven out of Spain, they settled in the Middle East and were accepted. Had the Zionists been willing to live with their fellow Arabs, I suspect they would have been as well accepted as the Sephardic Jews had been 5 centuries earlier, or 4 centuries earlier.
All right, well,
Thank you. You
comment on any of that that you like.
Well, I think the basic outline that the caller has presented is correct, and it's important to note that, Palestine was a province of the Ottoman Empire, ruled by the Ottoman Turks for 400 years, basically from 1517 through 1917. During that period in Palestine, there continued to be a very small remnant of the original historical Jewish population living among a majority population of Muslim Arabs and Christian Arabs and, you know, some Baha'i, some Cherkessians, very small other communities. And during this 400-year period, Palestine was not, to my understanding, historical understanding, necessarily a cosmopolitan center. However, there was intense agricultural cultivation of the country by the Palestinian landed classes and the peasantry. The port cities of Jaffa and Haifa were commercially developed. Inland, the city of Nablus was industrially developed for its day. And, of course, Jerusalem remained a center for pilgrimage. So, yes, things started to change in terms of the demographics, meaning an increasing Jewish population, and patterns of land ownership once the Turkish period of rule came to an end after World War I, and the British took over Palestine as a mandate. And through that British-controlled mandate of Palestine began to allow Zionist, meaning Jewish, immigration to Palestine from Eastern Europe. And during this roughly 30-year period from 1917, or actually 1920 through 1947, the population demographics began to shift and the patterns of land ownership began to shift. And this is the contemporary root of the political discord culminating in the events of 1948 that we see continue to play out and have yet to resolve themselves 60 years later in the 60th anniversary year of this conflict, 2008.
Next is caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just want to make a statement that I really, personally, I feel like I'm under no illusions about what's going on here. I don't think there's balanced reporting. I think there are all these issues. Lieberman and the Bush regime, who are tightly connected together. Hagee, who is tightly connected with some of the Zionist or Israelis. Things aren't being reported, like the fact that Jewish people have green lawns while the Palestinians that live across the street have no water to drink. The education's deprived. from the Palestinians. There's corporate control of our news. Much of the news media is controlled by Israel here. There are peace marches by both sides, by women, and those are not reported. And we sell weapons, I'm sure, in great numbers to Israel. That's all I have to say, and I'd like her response.
Well, responding to some of the disparate types of things you mentioned, I would say yes. There are many, you know, demonstrations and sort of peace efforts that go on the ground over there that we can easily read about in English language, Israeli media and Arab media online that are not reported by the American media. That's true. Certainly, the sales and granting and sales of sophisticated armaments to Israel is also true. This is acknowledged in the mainstream media in a passing way, but it is never really looked at in depth. That's correct. I'm not sure what the caller had in mind or specifically meant by the statement that Israel controls much of the American media. I'm not sure quite what to make of that. The observation about corporate media, I think we've already touched on that. That when there is, you know, media become bottom line and profit driven to the extent that they are today, that further reduces the incentive and even the resources available to do more in-depth reporting.
All right. Again, we'll go to another caller here. This is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. It was mentioned actually from one of the callers, Lebanon. I think probably one of the biggest mistakes there was that we didn't play a bigger role, the U.S., in terms of that conflict or whatever it was called. I mean, just a lot of destruction. So I don't know. I'll just go off the air and let you comment on that.
Well, the question is, what a bigger role in what direction? Can we get the caller back?
He hung up.
He hung up, yeah. I'm not exactly sure what the intention there was when you say bigger role. Bigger role in trying to stop it, a bigger role in trying to expand it and sort of, you know, as some on the right say, finish the job. I'm just not sure how to respond to that because I'm not sure.
I would guess, but I'm only guessing, and I don't want to put words in the caller's mouth, but I would think he would say that the United States, I think there are some people that would say that the United States could have played a bigger role in trying to stop the fighting sooner. And not let it go on as long as it did.
Well, certainly, if we're talking about the second Israel-Lebanon war that played out in the summer of, where are we?
This is 2006,
I believe it was, summer before last.
Okay.
Certainly, it's absolutely true that as the, you know, in those 31 or 32 days of fighting, during which considerable destruction was visited on Lebanon by Israeli air forces, air power. As this was going on, and there were many international calls for a ceasefire, Condoleezza Rice was on tour, basically saying, "No, Israel needs to keep going, and it's not, you know, they need to do what they need to do." Now, if you subscribe to the reporting of Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker after that, his assessment was that the, you know, one of the American interests in seeing this Israeli campaign through and not calling to an end or a sooner end to it was that it was meant as a test case. If Israel could prevail over Hezbollah in Lebanon, then perhaps it or the United States could carry out a similar operation against suspected Iranian nuclear targets. That was Seymour Hersh's assessment. So that's what I would say about that. But yes, certainly, our policy in that one was widely seen as encouraging the fighting to go on beyond a point that it should have.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of minutes left here. I think we have a previous caller wanted to maybe follow up on his comments. We'll go here to Urbana on line three. Yes, go ahead.
Actually, what I wanted to do was comment on the person who referred to Jewish control of the American press. And I suspect what they meant was the tendency of certain individuals to instantly attack any criticism of Israel as anti-Semitism. And as a case in point, I would point to ex-President Carter's reference to the situation as an apartheid condition, which is perhaps a very good condition of what description of the condition in Palestine today. President Carter is certainly not an anti-Semite. He does not deny the truth and validity of the Holocaust, which certainly occurred. But this new, what is sometimes referred to as anti-Semitism, I think, is probably what she meant, the reflexive and very quick and, I think, excessive criticism of any criticism of the state of Israel, usually referring to it as anti-Semitism. And thank you.
All right. Well, again, you can comment on that if you like.
I think that speaks for itself.
We have a couple after this program. I start to hear from people who think, there you go again, you're pro-Palestinian or you're anti-Israeli. They would say your guest is, and that I am because I put you on the radio. Do you feel that you have some sort of leaning one way or another?
I've spent a lot of time in the region. I've been going back and forth for more than 25 years with several extended stays that lasted about 2 years each. I've lived in Israel among Israelis and also among Palestinians who are citizens of Israel. I understand and speak both of the languages. My concern here and my analysis in the book is intended as a critique of the reporting. I think a lot of what's left out of it may support and lend credence to the Palestinian point or points of view. And I don't think necessarily that calling for, no, I won't say necessarily, I don't think at all that calling for a broader, more contextual reporting of this conflict and in turn a broader public discourse and discussion of these issues because certain important contextual things are left out, or when sensitive points are raised, as the last caller observed, there is a tendency to try to want to quash them. Some people will say, well, that makes you pro-Palestinian. My point of view is that people on both sides of that conflict are suffering. It's gone on for a very long time. I think the very first caller or one of our first callers observed that maybe half the people over there want to resolve it and the rest don't. My interaction with Israelis and Palestinians over the course of 25 years tells me that it's a much greater proportion than half. Hmm. Because Israelis and Palestinians, the majority of them, the overwhelming majority of them, like people anywhere else, want to live normal, secure, day-to-day existences. They're tired of this conflict, and they want to see a resolution to it. So I think American journalism has an important role to play,
yeah.
And that's my point of view.
Well, that's and again, I guess I want people to come away with the understanding that our intent here and your intent with this book is not so much to make political commentary on this conflict, but to do media criticism, to do analysis of the way the media has covered the issue. And again, that your feeling is that the serious problem here is not so much what has been reported, but what has not been reported. And if anything, you're saying, well, there ought to be more and more thorough reporting of this issue, in particular talking about everything that, not just the day-to-day events, the day-to-day violence, but this larger frame in which this exists.
Absolutely. And by the way, anyone who's spent time over there, or even if you haven't spent time in the region and you're just exposed to the conflict one way or another from a distance, and this includes journalists who, of course, have, in the course of reporting the story, have been in the thick of it, people have political opinions. I have political opinions. I'm sure most, if not all, of our callers have political opinions. But again, that's not the point. The point is, what is the reporting? How did it get to be the way it is? How could it be better? And how could that contribute toward a resolution of the conflict? What I've written here is not a political analysis per se, and the book does not dare to offer, and here's how we can solve the conflict. It's analysis of the media coverage.
Do you just quickly here now, particularly because of the internet, people have much greater access to various kinds of reporting coming out of a lot of other places, not just of American sources, but sources around the world. Are there any sources that you think are in the coverage of the Middle East that you think are particularly good, or at least you would say, I'm sure that you would say you can't just read one, but sources that will at least give you a better picture about what's going on, or at least that come closer, sources that are closer to the story?
Well, I think that once, if we're looking for sources outside the United States that are sort of freed to one degree or another from sticking so closely to this American foreign policy line, there are many good sources. I'd start with Haaretz, which is an Israeli daily newspaper published in Hebrew and English in print in Israel, published in Hebrew and English online on a daily basis, which is a very good source of information. Editorially, Haaretz tends to lean to the left. There's also the Jerusalem Post, which is in English, both print and online, tends to lean editorially to the right, but you will get different perspectives there. The BBC is a good source. And even if you're able to get access to, on a daily basis, to compare the reporting of the British wire service Reuters and the French wire service AFP, Agence France-Presse, also releases their stuff in English, you can see different angles on the daily events reported as opposed to, let's say, the Associated Press.
All right,
so there are many good sources.
Our guest, Marta Dunsky, her book is Pens and Swords, How the American Mainstream Media Report the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, published by the Columbia University Press. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for the show comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. We're going to break now for an update on markets and the news. We'll be back, so stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at... the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade in the corn pit. We're seeing some profit taking today after the prices rose yesterday, tied to both surging wheat prices as well as the crude oil market and a weakening U.S. dollar. We're also picking up that U.S. farmers are moving large amounts of corn today, both new as well as previous sales, sparked by weakening basis values at Midwest elevators.